This week's episode of Random Trek is brought to you by The Rise and Fall of Dodo by master storyteller Nicole Gullard and the best-selling author of Cryptonomicon, Neal Stephenson. A linguist, a military spy, a quantum physicist, and witches all must travel in time to bring back magic. Take the trip, too. Make sure to read The Rise and Fall of Dodo. You can check out The Rise and Fall of Dodo now at harpercollins.com. That's harpercollins.com. Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast in which I, your host, Scott McNulty, discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. My guest tonight, or this morning, depending on what part of the world you're in, is Katie Mack. Katie, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
I'm excited. You're an astrophysicist, but so you can explain all the science in Star Trek, I assume. If I have any questions about science in Star Trek, I'm just going to ask you from now on. I hope that's okay.
Okay, I'll do my best.
Do you want to tell the people a little bit about yourself before we jump in?
Sure. I'm an astrophysicist. I'm a researcher at the University of Melbourne in Australia, but originally I'm from Los Angeles, and I'll be moving back to the States in a few months, actually, to take up a faculty job, and I really like Star Trek, so... Yeah.
Oh, excellent. Well, you answered my next question. My next question was going to be, where in the United States are you moving to? But I don't know if you want to tell people that, so I won't ask.
No, that's fine. I'm going to North Carolina, North Carolina State University. I'll be an assistant professor of physics there.
Oh, well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, you already answered that you're a Star Trek fan. So
yeah.
My follow-up question to that has to be, if you had to pick a series to be your favorite, which series would you pick?
So that's very easy. Next Generation by a mile. I like Deep Space Nine. I enjoy original series. I haven't watched very much. Well, I've watched maybe like half of Voyager, and somehow I just missed Enterprise entirely. So, but Next Generation is what I grew up with, and I guess that's comes into it, but I think it's the most, I don't know, well put together series, I suppose, although not as we'll discuss in the first season necessarily.
Yes, we people who are listening already know the episode we're going to talk about is Where No One Has Gone Before, which is a first season episode. It's the sixth episode, actually, of Star Trek The Next Generation that ever aired. And I will say, every time I watch a first season episode of The Next Generation, which is a show I love, I am surprised that it got a second season.
Yeah. I was just chatting with a friend of mine who had never watched Next Generation before. And she was starting from the beginning. And she was three or four episodes in and saying, like, does it get better? Because I told her it got better. I told her, like, you know, you have to hold out and just, you know, keep going. It will get better. And she's like, are you sure? And I'm like, yes, really. You can do it. Just get through the first few. You'll be all right.
This isn't some sort of elaborate experiment you're making me go through.
Yeah.
Yeah, the first I would say the first two seasons are pretty tough going.
For
Star Trek: The Next Generation, and I would say that applies actually to most Star Trek series, with the notable exception of the original series, because the first two seasons of the original series are probably the best two seasons of the original series of Star Trek. Series, of the original series. Yes, they're not the best Star Trek series ever. Although they do have some of the best Star Trek episodes ever, depending on if you're okay, if you can look past the problems with a 50-year-old TV show.
Right.
If you can't, then they're not good at all. But we're not talking about the original series. We're talking about TNG. So it's your favorite series. I will agree with you that it is my favorite series. People who listen to this podcast know that I have two favorites, really. I have my favorite, which is the TNG. I have what I think is the best series, which is Deep Space Nine. And I can, because I think it tells a more complicated story, and I like the fact that it came at a later time, so they have arcs, right? So the things that happen in earlier seasons have repercussions, whereas in a lot of TNG, you fly past three galaxies, and then the next episode, you never speak of it again.
Yeah.
Although the Traveler does come back, so.
Mm-hmm.
And he takes away Wesley, which, depending on how you feel about Wesley, is either a good or a bad thing. But we'll get to Wesley. He features it on this episode as well. But my question, that was a long way of me asking a question about TNG, which is, who's your favorite character on TNG?
Oh, gosh. I mean, Picard, obviously. And I think one of the interesting things, so in preparation for this podcast, I figured that this episode is so close to the beginning, I'll just watch the first few, you know, again, and to get the context. And so I watched those. And interestingly, Picard is one of the few characters who doesn't seem completely lost in the first few episodes in terms of figuring out who his character is and, you know, I don't know, sort of just being in the moment and being part of the scene. I don't know. He seems much more comfortable in everything than a lot of the other characters do. I mean, it's interesting because he's still kind of, they haven't figured out whether to make him like a nice person or not yet in this the first few episodes. And so that part comes through a little bit, but he definitely seems more like Picard than any of the other characters seem like themselves, in the first few episodes. But yeah, I mean, I think Picard is one of the best characters in all of Star Trek everywhere. So he would definitely be my favorite, but I don't know. When I was a kid, I really liked Data. I liked Wesley. I know that was a very unpopular thing, but you know, this episode came out when I was six, and you know, as a nerdy child who loved science and loved hanging out with adults and talking about smart things, Wesley seemed awesome to me.
And Wesley, I assume, was created to be a stand-in for a child just like you, so that you could, as you were watching it, you could think, I want to be Wesley. He's on the Enterprise. He's doing cool stuff.
Yeah.
He's, for some reason, hanging out in main engineering.
Yeah, exactly.
which seems problematic from a security perspective, but as we've discovered, Starfleet security regulations are very lax.
Yes.
Especially in this episode, you know, this guy comes aboard, Kaczynski, who is a Starfleet something. He doesn't have a rank insignia or a communicator on his uniform.
I was trying to figure out what his little square pin was on his rank thing, but I don't know if that was like something that engineers get.
Yeah, I don't know. He is an enigma because his rank is never used, and he is also not a very nice person in general. So he's kind of a jerk. But yeah, he shows up. He has like this gibberish, seemingly gibberish formula that he wants to use to fix the or fine tune the Enterprise's warp engines, and everybody's like, this just doesn't seem like it's gonna work. And Picard's like, well, let's just give it a try. Which seems problematic to me.
Yeah, I guess they figured out that it wasn't gonna be dangerous, right? So like whatever he was gonna do couldn't possibly hurt. And so just let him do it. It was really interesting. This episode in general was very interesting for me to watch as a physicist for a number of reasons, which I think we'll probably talk about some of them and, you know, about where they go and what they see and all that. Mm-hmm. But also just the way that, I mean, okay, so Star Trek has a lot of meaningless technobabble in it. That's just part of what, you know, you have to sort of set the scene. But in this one, it seemed like somebody who knew a little bit about, you know, science or physics put in some technobabble that would definitely not mean anything at all. And then have the other characters realize that it meant nothing at all and sort of roll their eyes. And it reminded me of my inbox, you know, like my email inbox. Like, you know, people write to me saying, you know, like, I have discovered the meaning of the universe, and it's that consciousness is deeply embedded with physics, and you know all this stuff, and it doesn't mean anything, you know, and it's you can tell if you have some training that it doesn't mean anything, but they have these sort of, you know, deep sounding concepts, and and the stuff that Kaczynski was saying really, really reminded me of those kinds of, you know, people who think that they've discovered something really deep by saying, you know, what if the mind connects with physics and all of this stuff. So the reaction of all the other characters was like how actual physicists respond when they get, you know, messages from people like that. So it was funny to see that from the perspective of somebody who, you know, has to deal with people who talk like that quite a lot.
Well, this is just another example of big science trying to keep the truth from us,
right.
Consciousness controls everything. And,
right, exactly. Yeah.
I did know I was looking at your website earlier, and I like that in your frequently asked questions, you have a question that says, can I send you my theory of the universe? And the answer is no, please don't.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. A lot of people don't read that.
Yeah. I think probably some people do read it and still send it to you.
Yeah.
My wife is not a physicist. She is a canner and a preserving person and a food writer. So she writes a lot of recipes. And she gets a lot of emails in a similar vein where people email her and they say, I really like your blueberry jam recipe. Can I do it with three other different ingredients and follow the same exact recipe? And she's like, that's a completely different recipe. I don't know. Try it. And why are you asking me?
Yeah.
I feel like any profession, you get that now, thanks to the internet.
Yeah, probably. I mean, yeah, I think it just varies, like, what people sort of latch on to. In my case, I got a lot of emails from people complaining about the decisions of the Nobel Prize Committee.
Because you're on the Nobel Prize Committee.
Yeah, I mean, there's some people who I mean, I can't imagine being on the Nobel Prize Committee, like, what kinds of messages you would get. But they send them to me as well. And then, right. And then just lots of people who want to generously share with me their solution to the, you know, theories of everything. And and several of those will be worried that I'll steal the theory if they tell me right out. So they give me like a phone number or something to call. I do not call.
You could have been missing many. You could have missed your chance to talk to someone like Kaczynski.
I could be on the other side of the universe right now if only I'd listened.
You could be. You could have went through three galaxies and then entered the realm of consciousness or wherever the heck they end up.
Yep.
And then you could think about fire and it could appear in the corridor.
Right.
But we're getting ahead of ourselves, though. I do have a question, though, for you as a scientist. Could you explain to me Wesley's sweater?
I cannot. He wears like two different ones in this show, which are just astonishing. I don't know how anybody could have thought that they were a good idea.
I don't know.
I've read a little bit of stuff that Will Wheaton has written about his time on Star Trek, and he has bitter complaints about those sweaters, and they're really amazing.
Those are well-founded complaints because, boy, those sweaters are not good. Although I have found, I have a theory about Star Trek characters in that they are so used to, it doesn't work with Wesley because he doesn't wear a uniform until later, but most Star Trek characters wear a uniform. And when they are not wearing a uniform, they just do not have any idea how to dress themselves. So I feel like Captain Picard certainly falls into this category.
Oh, his outfit on Riser that one time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Somebody must have said, you know, Patrick Stewart, you look really good in blousy shirts. So we're just going to give you a lot of blousy shirts and tight pants and see what happens.
Yeah.
But he does not. He stays in his uniform the entire time this episode. So if you haven't seen this episode and you're hoping to see casual Picard, you will be disappointed. We're not even close to the beginning of this episode. But basically, we should probably go back to the episode. I will say I was excited as a Star Trek geek. My favorite starship class is the Excelsior class. And so the USS Fearless, which brings Kaczynski and his assistant, the Traveler, who we don't know is the Traveler at the time, is an Excelsior class. I'm always excited to see an Excelsior class starship. So, hooray. But yeah, so this guy Kaczynski, he has this theory that will make warp engines work better. Riker is looked it over, much as you, Katie, look at these wacky emails that you get and shake your head. And he's like, this doesn't make any sense. The chief engineer, who is not Geordi, I always forget in the early episodes, Geordi is not the chief engineer. It is some guy named Argyle, who doesn't last long, also thinks it's gibberish. So everybody is a little skeptical. And this is Deanna Troi gets to do almost nothing except walk next to Riker and meet Kaczynski, who is a real jerk. And then Riker turns to her and says, he's a real jerk. And she says, yes, he is.
But then she gets to say that, you know, the assistant doesn't register at all, which is, you know, gives you some kind of like, ooh, he's weird, he's special.
Yes, the assistants, I will say, I love the fact that Paramount and CBS or whoever, I don't know who did it, spent a whole bunch of money to HDify TNG, and it looks beautiful. Mm. The downside is that the Traveler's makeup, which was never meant to be seen in HD, is being seen in HD, and it doesn't really hold up all that well. But
yeah, actually, I noticed that Worf's makeup doesn't hold up all that well in some of the early episodes either. Yeah,
Worf and the Targ that shows up later is kind of laughable. Oh, but yes. I feel like it's an endearing laughable.
Yeah.
Oh, the Targ, and there's a cat. So if you like cats, there's a cat later too. So yeah, basically the first half of this episode is everybody bristling at this jerky Kaczynski, who calls Wesley the boy. Although I guess almost everybody calls him boy, other than the Traveler in this episode for some reason, until the end when he proves himself.
Kaczynski calls him a child.
Oh yes, that's true.
Yeah.
And he's like, what is this child doing in engineering? And everyone's like, he's got a school project. That's what he's doing there. And they don't tell us what the project is, but he's there. So yeah, so he's Kaczynski's there. He's like, I need to type in some stuff into your computer because I'm super smart. But my assistant is a much faster typist than I am.
Even though he's only got, I think, six fingers.
Six
altogether.
Fingers, yes. And so the assistant, who you think there's something up with this assistant, does all the typing. And he has on his screen like some, I don't know, graphic of what I only assume is a warp bubble, because I know the Traveler in later episodes, they talk about warp bubbles. And he shows it to Wesley, and Wesley is like, oh, that looks nice. And the Traveler says, well, what do you think of it? And he says, well, or he says, do you think it'll work, right? And Wesley says, well, I think if you change this and this and this, it'll probably work. And the Traveler is quite impressed, as was I, because I had no idea what was going on. And Wesley is smart. That's how we know, right? This may be the first episode that Wesley really gets a lot of. He doesn't really get a lot, but he's kind of a pivotal character. And so this is like, okay, Wesley is smart.
Well, in the previous, it was, I don't know if it was the previous episode, in one of the couple of episodes before, he also he builds this little like home tractor beam set, and then that ends up being really important later in the episode. I mean, that's so in the Naked Now, I guess, is the horrible one where everybody gets drunk. Wesley takes over main engineering. So it is a little bit surprising that they've let him back into main engineering at all ever to do another school project, which is also what allowed him to lock everyone out in that other episode. So that, you know, continuity, a little bit interesting there.
Yes. And you would think, so even within, to your point, Wesley has kind of proven himself as someone who you should probably at least listen to. And Riker does not listen to Wesley at all because, you know, the Kaczynski is fiddling around, putting in his bogus equations. The Traveler is phasing in and out as he is actually doing all of the work. And they go to warp 1.5, but then they are rapidly accelerating past warp 10. And everyone's like, OMG, what's going on? What have you done, Kaczynski? And Wesley's like, I don't think Kaczynski did anything. I think it's the assistant. And Riker will hear none of it.
No.
For no particular reason.
Yeah, just because.
He's like, shut up, kid. I'm angry at this other jerk. I'll talk to you later. I'd love to hear your little story when we have a moment. But this is, I think at this point, this is when they go really fast and we see like galaxies swimming past and things. We see a lot of things happening.
Yeah.
Which I would imagine sort of... is not accurate, but I don't know if that's true or not.
I mean, who knows what you see? Who knows what you see at Warp 10, right? Like, you know, neon pathways of twisting, like, who knows? Yeah, okay, fine. that part's fine. But then they get to the place. So they go, you know, past Warp 10, the velocity is off the scale, as Data says. And then, you know, Picard says, you know, reverse the engines and Data says, you know, this might blow up the ship, and they're like, do it anyway, and it's fine, nothing at all happens, they just stop. But then they get to this place that's supposed to be like, you know, millions of light years away, and the way that you can tell it's really far away is that it looks totally different from anything else. So there's this sort of like huge galaxy planet thing with rings, and then there's this shining thing in the background, which is actually Centaurus A, which is a radio galaxy. But anyway, that's this sort of bright thing in the background, and there's this sort of lots of sparkles and lots of things shining, and they say that they've gone through two galaxies, past a third, and they're, you know, 3 million light years away. And I find that really funny because, you know, we know what those galaxies look like, and they're not that different. You know, there's like, I mean, the one of the things that's really funny about this episode is that the Copernican principle is just totally broken. The Copernican principle is this idea that the universe is pretty much the same everywhere. And observationally, as astrophysicists, we see that, you know, the distant galaxies don't look that different from ours, and you know, everywhere you go in the universe, things look more or less the same. But it's interesting how they use the shorthand for "we've gone a long way" is that things are totally different in this other place.
They're a billion light years away, and I assume that a billion light years away, everything looks like you're inside a cloud, and there are giant fireflies buzzing around.
Yeah. I mean, that's what they. And you know, again, like when you get to that part of the show, like we have also seen a billion light years away, and it's not that different either. I mean,
you're harshing my buzz here with your science.
I'm sorry. It's just, I don't mean to nitpick the science.
You to nitpick the science.
It's just interesting from the point of view of, you know, the numbers that they're throwing around to try to, you know, to try to sound like this is really big and really different and really distant. Mm-hmm. Are numbers that, as astrophysicists, we work with, and you know, it's just not that it's not that big a thing,
right? But I think that's the problem. Like, the universe is really, really, really big.
Yeah.
And so, even a billion light years, although that sounds really big to someone who is not an astrophysicist or an astronomer, when you hear it, you're like, well, that's, you know, we deal with that every day, so you're not that far away, people.
Right.
You're still in the same neighborhood, or maybe the next neighborhood over. I don't know.
But. I mean, you know, we have no idea what things look like when you get that in this. If you actually went there, because we can't. But in terms of what we see all the time, it's not that different. But it is kind of interesting to see, like, you know, that sort of things are weird and shiny, standing in for "we've got a long way."
That's right. And then when they get there, that's not even the weirdest part, right? The way it looks, but rather how reality functions. It's completely different there. So not only are there big fireflies buzzing around outside, but your very mind can, create reality, right? So apparently we see many instances of this. Well, maybe not many, but a few.
Worf's
on the bridge, and he's thinking about his childhood Targ, apparently, and then his Targ appears, and it looks so cute. And then Tasha Yar says, "Oh, what the heck is that?" Now, I will say, a Targ just appears randomly on the bridge. Mm-hmm. Nobody seems that concerned.
Yeah, they're just like, "Oh, cool."
That's awesome. And Tasha Yar is like, "Oh, you mean that's a kitty cat? Because it's actually like this." I think they use some kind of like a warthog or something.
Just a pig, and they put like a little goth coat on a pig. But
It's a goth pig.
Yeah.
And she's like, oh, you mean that's a kitty cat? And then when she says that, of course, her cat appears, her childhood cat. And, you know, the one thing that you know about Tasha Yar is that she grew up on a planet that was not great. And so she is transported back to her memory of her past. And so I kind of had a little whiplash in that we see a cute cat, and then she immediately thinks back to her past as she's being chased by a rape gang. And you think, that's really kind of whipping me back and forth here, Star Trek.
And that whole thing about, you know, if someone's a strong woman, she has to have had a horrible traumatic past with sexual violence mm-hmm. and all of that. And that's kind of like, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, we did. I always questioned why they decided, you know, Tasha Yar, you need to come from a planet that's most notable export are rape gangs. It doesn't seem great. But anyway, so she's there. LaForge taps her on the shoulder, basically, and she snaps out of it. One of my favorite scenes in this whole episode is Captain Picard is on a turbo lift, and I think he's going to engineering. The door opens, he steps out, and he is stepping out into space.
Yeah. That was an awesome scene. I thought that was really great, just in terms of, I don't know, the kind of thing that you might kind of have these little freakouts about if you live on a starship. Mm-hmm. And the special effects for that were done really well. And just the way that, I don't know, it looked really cool.
Yes. And I don't have to say that I'm a nerd since I host a Star Trek podcast. but I also, when I was in high school and college, the Star Trek customizable card game was a thing. And that card game basically had cards based from many of the episodes of Star Trek. And you would not be surprised to find out that many cards come from this very episode because of this section where wacky stuff is happening.
Right.
And one of my favorite cards features that very scene. But he doesn't fall out. He goes back, and then the doors close. He opens it up again, and he sees his dead mother drinking tea in the corridor.
Yeah. And they have a little chat.
I found her accent to be distracting. I wasn't quite sure what it was supposed to be.
Sort of, but I think she's French. I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, because Captain Picard has an English accent, but he's French.
Yes.
So I guess his mother is French and has a German accent, so it's all fine.
Sure. Why not?
I will say, though, that this episode proves that the Enterprise crew is a classy lot, because we see two random crew members, and one of them has created like a chamber orchestra that he's playing with.
Yes.
And the other is a ballerina in the cargo bay.
I felt a little bad for her. Like, she's doing this you know, lovely little ballerina routine, and then Picard comes by and just shouts at her for no reason. Like, why can't she practice ballet in the cargo bay? Like, she's not bothering anybody.
It's true. I think this is to your point where they hadn't decided if Picard was nice or not.
Yeah.
He just yells at everybody in this episode. And he also, so yeah, weird things are happening. He figures out that it is because, you know, they're shaping reality with their thoughts. And so he says, well, I better get on the ship-wide announcement thing and tell everybody not to think of anything bad.
That went better than I thought it would, honestly.
That seems like the worst idea possible to me. Because I think it is human nature when you say, hey, don't think of anything bad. Like, it's that thing where, like, don't think of a pink elephant. And then the only thing you can then think of is a pink elephant, because that is the one thing you're not supposed to think of.
Yeah. Control your thoughts, he says.
Exactly. Everybody be cool.
Yeah.
Focus on the task at hand. Don't think about anything crazy.
Right. Right.
That doesn't work super great, but I guess only one crew member is thinking of fire, apparently. And so and Captain Picard's solution to that is to yell at him and tell him to stop.
Yeah, that went well.
And it worked.
It did, yeah. One of the things that I noticed in the scenes of just, you know, there are lots of scenes of just crew members, you know, because everybody's sort of running around, bad things are happening. And this is one of the episodes where you get to see the male miniskirt uniform, which only appears in a couple of episodes in the first half of the first season and then is never heard from again. But I really appreciate that you get to see at least one male character walking around in the miniskirt uniform, which is awesome.
Yes, it is one of those things where I think Gene Roddenberry was like, well, we need to, you know, prove that in the future it doesn't matter what people are wearing, and so some men want to wear miniskirts, and that's cool.
Yeah.
Which I agree with. It's fine, but apparently it did not catch on. So, yeah.
Alas.
Oh, well. Although I like to imagine that it is kind of an option that you get to pick what uniform you want to wear.
And, yeah, I mean, I think that was the idea, because there are women wearing the miniskirt uniform, there are men wearing the miniskirt uniform, mm-hmm. It's fine. But I do also like that by this episode, they at least let Troy wear pants now, because she didn't in the first, and it was clearly a terrible idea. So,
And I was thinking about Troy. I often think about Troy as I watch TNG because she is an ill-served character throughout most of it. And I always wonder in the first half of TNG why they just didn't let her wear a uniform.
Yeah, it is really strange that she's the only one who has to wear something like super sexualized, and everybody else is fine. I mean, because it's not like she's the only alien or half alien on the show.
No. And she has a rank, like she is a member of Starfleet. It doesn't make any sense to me.
So
I saw on the internet, because I Googled this before we started, because in case there was some reason and someone would angrily, so, you know, people email you about their theories of the universe. People email me about getting things wrong about Star Trek, which I do on occasion. One of my favorites is I spent an entire episode talking about Voyager and calling Chakotay Chipotle. Once you start saying it, it's hard to stop. And so I figured if I'd ask that question, someone would be like, oh, don't you remember in like the fourth episode, she explains that it's against Beta Z culture or something. So I Googled it and there's no good reason. And so there are some fan theories that she wears it to make people feel comfortable, which I think is not a great theory. But anyway.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, Worf has to wear his sash thing because that's a Klingon thing. And, you know, in Deep Space Nine, Kira has to wear an earring or whatever. But, like, you know, there's nothing that says, like, you know, Troy, Beta's always have to show cleavage. Like, I just don't. she just does. So
she's just comfortable that way. Well, they're stuck now. They're stuck in this place where their very thoughts are messing stuff up. Kaczynski is kind of thinking, hey, I'm great. I have caused us to travel faster than anyone ever. I should really be lauded. And everyone's like, dude, we are stranded a billion light years away. And I think Picard has a good rejoinder to that is, but isn't the real question if you can do it again and get us back? And he's like, of course I can. Whatever.
Yeah.
His assistant, the traveler, is tuckered out, apparently, and in sickbay. And Beverly Crusher, who doesn't get to do much in this episode, doesn't know how to help him. He's tired, doesn't know. He turns out he's fine. And he and Captain Picard have a talk about Wesley Crusher, who says that Wesley Crusher is the traveler, says that Wesley Crusher is like Mozart, except that he can, instead of music, he can manipulate time, space, and thought, which seems kind of awesome.
Yeah.
Who knew? So not only is he smart, he has superpowers. And then he says basically to the traveler, I know, I finally asked Wesley. He tells me that you're the one that's doing this. How do we get back? And this is where we get this seemingly an email to you about how the universe works, because it turns out that it's really just your thoughts that can directly impact the universe, and all kinds of stuff happens. So you have to think really hard that you want to go home, click your heels three times, and you go home.
And there's the whole thing where everybody has to think really hard about the traveler being healthy and happy, and that works. And
you have to clap so that Tinkerbell won't die at the end.
Yeah.
And the traveler, he is a character that is he shows up a couple times. He takes Wesley away. He seems to be very powerful. He's enigmatic, which I like, because a lot of the time aliens on Star Trek are kind of one note and very similar to humans, except they are one particular thing exaggerated. So Klingons are very aggressive, Vulcans are very logical, that kind of thing. The Traveler is just kind of like, I am not like you. you can't even pronounce my name. I have 3 fingers on each hand. I'm crazy. And he just travels around.
Yeah, he's an interesting one because he clearly has some kind of superpowers with, you know, space and time and all of, and thought and all of that. But he's kind of just lying to everybody about, you know, who he is and using them to get places. And but then apparently what he does when he gets there is just, you know, help out with the warp tuning. So it's a little unclear exactly what his purpose is, but I guess he just kind of wants to go around and meet people and have fun. And yeah, he's just kind of a chill guy.
He's like an intergalactic hobo going from camp to camp, hanging out. I do like there is a moment where he says, he explains basically that, you know, he hitchhikes on starships and sees the universe and hangs out with people and helps them with their warp engines, yeah. As you do. And Riker's like, how come there's no record of you? How come we don't know anything about your race? And his response is, he's like, well, how arrogant that you would think that we would have visited you. This is the first time we're visiting you. You're not that interesting. Up until this point, there was no reason for me to see you.
I thought that was great. Yeah, a sort of a nice solution to the Fermi paradox, you know, of why we haven't heard from aliens. We're just not that interesting yet. And, you know, maybe once we've developed warp drive and, you know, we're actually going out there and doing things, then they'll be like, okay, let's check these people out. But yeah, I thought that was kind of a nice scene.
And Kaczynski has this nice bit where he's like, you know, we've been traveling the stars at warp speeds for 300 years, and we've only mapped 11% of our galaxy. So think of all the awesome things we can now do. I don't know if those numbers check out, but he makes a good point, although he's kind of a jerk, that this is exciting, although he had nothing to do with it. So, you know. And one assumes at the end of this episode that he is a broken man, his career is in tatters because he's done nothing.
He does, you know, there is a sort of cute scene where when the travelers is getting them home, he has Kaczynski sit across from him and do his little, you know, data entry thing or something. And Kaczynski's like, oh, you need me. And,
you know, I feel like I got the feeling that it's like when a parent is cooking and like their kid wants to help and they're like, okay, here, you just like mix this flour and this water. And though the recipe doesn't need flour or water.
I don't know. I thought it was very kind of the traveler in any case to include Kaczynski.
Kaczynski, you could tell he's one of these characters who he really believes in what he's doing, and he feels like he can. Well, he thinks he's a genius and he thinks he's smarter than everybody, but he also thinks that what he's doing is going to help a lot of people. And it just turns out that his equations are meaningless, but. He has that force of will to make it happen. So kudos to him, at least. But yeah, so the traveler, they're stuck, but the traveler's like, I can fix this, I think. And so he and Kaczynski sit down at the old engineering table at the weird chairs that everyone gathers around the engineering table. And Wesley is there. They turn back. They don't turn back. They're back right where they started at the end of this episode, which happens a lot in Star Trek The Next Generation. The traveler has phased away for, I guess, because that's the way it works.
Yeah.
And Picard says, you know what? Let's get that Wesley Crusher up on the bridge. And so Wesley comes up and he doesn't want to leave the turbo lift. So Picard's like, you know, get out of the elevator, Wesley. and they have this nice little scene where he's like, you know, I want you to stay and watch what's going on. And Riker's like, well, technically, it's against regulations to have, you know, someone who doesn't have a rank on the bridge. And Picard's like, oh, and Wesley's like, oh, I can leave, you know, it's not. And Wesley, Picard's like, be quiet, Wesley, we're trying to do something nice for you. You're totally ruining it.
Yeah.
And Picard's like, well, I guess I'll have to make him an acting ensign. And so he does. And so that's kind of nice. And he gets to sit down next to Troy and wear one of his ugly sweaters. And
I thought that was a really cute scene. I thought that the dynamic between Picard and Riker in this episode is really good. I think they're at the point where they're figuring out how to like relate to each other. And you know, the sort of little discussion that they're having for the benefit of Wesley is very cute. And he does seem just absolutely thrilled. And you know, he's sitting there on his little kid seat next to Troy, just beaming with joy at being on the bridge. And I thought it was a really sweet scene. Actually, I thought that, you know, the interactions between the characters were really nice there.
Yes, and I did think it was kind of weird. I thought it was very sweet, but then Picard then kind of orders Wesley to apply to Starfleet Academy. Well, that's kind of strange.
I mean, you know, he's trying to encourage him the way that the Traveler told him to. But I mean, it was clear that Wesley was going to want to go to Starfleet Academy anyway, right?
Like, that's the thing
that smart kids do in the future. So yeah, I think it made sense.
And spoiler alert, Wesley does apply and he gets in.
Yes. And then lots of things happen.
Yes, lots of things happen. Bad things. He starts running around with the wrong crowd. Somebody dies. It's mess. But I think it all turns out at the end. Mm-hmm. So speaking of the end, that is the end of this episode. There was one I just wanted to just popped into my mind. So when they're in like a billion light years away, and there's no time apparently. Captain Picard is like, you know, Captain's log, star date. Well, there's no time, so I'm not going to say what time it was. So I just thought that was fun. Mm. But what did you think, Katie, of this episode overall?
I mean, I quite enjoyed it. I think that, you know, compared to the other episodes, I think this was the first episode in the first season that wasn't completely cringeworthy the whole way through. that wasn't clearly a terrible episode, so that was nice. I thought that it was a sort of interesting premise, and the interactions between the characters was kind of interesting, you know, between the main crew and Kaczynski and you know, how they deal with somebody coming to mess with things, and then especially the dynamics between Riker and Picard and everybody and Wesley, I thought was quite interesting. So I enjoyed it. I thought it was a fun episode. You know, I think it's still clearly a first season episode. But I thought overall it worked pretty well.
I agree. I think that this is kind of one of the high watermarks, I think, in the first season. And I think a lot of that has to do with, you know, there's this story that Gene Roddenberry was really against kind of conflict amongst people in Starfleet. So you'll see in the first couple of seasons that everybody on the crew pretty much gets along. And, you know, without conflict, it's hard to tell a very compelling story. But this Kaczynski is an outside source, outside entity, but he is in Starfleet. But he's still kind of a jerk and causing conflict. So that makes it a little more interesting than your typical first season episode.
Yeah. And there was some interesting stuff too about the sort of balancing the desire to just explore and find out as much as you can and the desire to sort of play it safe and, you know, how that all comes together. Like there's this moment when they've traveled to this 3 million light years away galaxy. And Picard is taking advice from the crew about what to do next, you know, and somebody's like, oh, we should explore. And somebody's like, no, we need to go back. And do we really trust this Kaczynski guy and all that? And, you know, and it was a nice scene of getting different perspectives on what to do. And basically in the end, Picard says, well, if this works, then they can send a dedicated science vessel to do the exploration. So we don't need to, you know, sit around and take data. We can just try and get back. And that makes sense. But there's that, I thought it was good to see that sort of tension between like, we are just an exploratory vessel, you know, the whole point is to go new places and see new things. And this is clearly a new thing, but at the same time, like, you know, we don't want to be isolated from the rest of Starfleet. Like, who are we going to tell about these discoveries if we can't ever get back? So yeah, that it was an interesting thing to see that kind of discussed. And it was a nice sort of way to see his command style, you know, which is, of course, massive contrast to Kirk. And so that was a good way of sort of reinforcing that, you know, he's gonna make his own decision because he's the captain, but he's gonna take other people's ideas on board, and he's gonna give some explanation of what he's doing.
Right, he's not just going to say, let's blow something up.
Right, exactly. Although, you know, he does almost destroy the ship a couple of times in the first few episodes by doing stuff that is a really, you know, bad idea, like going, you know, reversing engines at high warp, or that one in Farpoint where he separates the saucer section at warp speed for no reason, and then has Riker put it back together manually for no reason again. And it's like, really?
Don't question his judgment. I did like when he was like, let's do reverse the engines, Mr. Data. And Data's like, no one has ever reversed engines at this speed, Captain. And his response is, that's because no one's ever gone this fast. Just do it. You think, well, maybe you want to think about it a little longer, but it works out. So
that's fine.
Well, Katie, thank you so much for joining me. This was great.
Thanks. It was a lot of fun.